Welcome back, Deep Divers. Ready to unearth some more legal gems with us?
Always ready to dig in.
Well, today, we're going deep on a case that's a cornerstone of family law. It's Santosky v. Kramer, and let me tell you, this one's got twists and turns that'll make you rethink everything you thought you knew about parental rights.
Yeah, this case is a real landmark decision. You know, on the surface, it seems pretty straightforward. When can the state step in and say, okay, enough is enough, we're terminating parental rights?
Right, like it should be black and white, cut and dry.
But trust me, it gets complicated fast. Santosky v. Kramer really forced the courts, and really the whole country, to take a hard look at that line. How do we balance the rights of parents with the absolute need to protect children?
Heavy stuff. And the story behind this case, well, it's heartbreaking, honestly.
It is. It all starts with the Santosky family. Over a span of like 5 years, from 1973 to 1978, the state of New York ended up removing all three of their kids from their care.
All three?
All three. The oldest, Tina, was first removed because of neglect. Then John, the middle child, taken away due to concerns about malnutrition. And then just 3 days after the youngest, Jed, was born, the state removed him too.
3 days after he was born. Wow, that's...
They considered it, they deemed it imminent danger to his health, according to the case files.
So this wasn't like a one-time slip-up. This was years of serious concerns.
Definitely. And during that time, social services were heavily involved trying to work with the parents. They offer all sorts of training, like child welfare classes, mental health services, even vocational skills training.
So the goal was to support them, help them become better parents.
Right. The idea was to keep the family together, if at all possible. But, and this is a big but, there wasn't much cooperation from the parents. They did, however, maintain some contact with the kids throughout those years.
It sounds like the state was really making an effort to keep this family intact, you know, not just jumping straight to the nuclear option.
Absolutely. It's an important part of the story. And then in 1978, after years of trying to work with them, social services made the decision to file a petition to terminate the Santosky's parental rights.
Wow. So they exhausted every other option, it seems.
They did. And this is where things get really interesting, legally speaking. At the time, the standard used in New York for termination of parental rights was a fair preponderance of the evidence standard.
Now, help me out here. For someone who's not a lawyer, what does that actually mean? Like, how much proof did they need?
Think of it like a scale. Just a little bit more weight on one side than the other, and that's enough to tip the scale.
So 51%, basically.
Yeah, just a sliver more evidence in favor of termination, and that's it. Parental rights gone.
That seems awfully low.
Yeah.
I mean, in criminal cases, you've got to prove guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, right? Where someone could go to jail, lose their freedom.
Exactly. And that's precisely what the Santoskys argued. They said, hold on, this fair preponderance standard, it's just not strong enough when you're talking about something as fundamental as our right to raise our children.
Makes sense to me. I mean, losing your kids, that's a huge loss.
Absolutely. And so their fight began, a fight that would ultimately change family law in America as we know it.
Okay, so this is heading to the Supreme Court, right?
Oh, it gets there eventually. But first, it goes through the ringer.
All right, so walk us through it. What happened?
So they start with a hearing in the family court of Ulster County. That was in 79. And the court, they rule against the Santoskys. They side with the state and say, yeah, parental rights terminated.
They did. Tough break.
But the Santoskys, they weren't giving up that easily. They appealed the decision to the appellate division.
Another chance to make their case.
Right. And the appellate division, well, they upheld the lower court's ruling, but it was a 3-2 decision.
So a split decision.
Exactly. And here's the key. That dissenting opinion, the two judges who disagreed, it was powerful. They basically said, look, using fair preponderance to sever parental rights, we might be violating some serious constitutional rights here.
So even though they lost, that dissent planted a seed.
It did. The Santoskys then tried to appeal to the New York Court of Appeals, but they dismissed the appeal. They didn't see a constitutional issue. But that powerful dissent, it caught the eye of the Supreme Court. They decided to take the case.
Talk about a David and Goliath story.
Yeah.
The little guy going up against the entire system. And now the highest court in the land is going to weigh in on this question. Does fair preponderance violate the Constitution, specifically the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, when it comes to taking away someone's right to be a parent?
And it's a huge question. You've got the fundamental right of parents to raise their children, a right that's deeply rooted in our legal history. We're talking landmark cases like Pierce v. Society of Sisters and Meyer v. Nebraska, cases that affirm this basic liberty interest parents have in directing the upbringing of their children.
So right off the bat, the court is saying, hey, parental rights, these are serious, folks. This is not something we take lightly.
Right. But then on the other side, you have this concept of parens patriae. It's Latin fancy lawyer stuff, but basically it means the state has a duty to step in, to act as a parent when a child's safety and well-being are in danger.
So it's this classic clash, individual rights versus the state's power to protect.
Uh-huh.
How in the world did the Supreme Court even begin to untangle this mess?
Well, they used a framework, a kind of test, established in a previous case, Matthews v. Eldridge. It's got three parts, three prongs, that the court uses to analyze due process claims. And applying those prongs to Santosky, that's where things get fascinating.
All right, lay it on me. What are those three prongs?
So prong number one, it focuses on what's at stake, the private interest that's on the line. And here, in Santosky, the court was crystal clear. Parental rights are huge. In their words, they're far more precious than property rights. They were saying, this is not about dividing up stuff in a divorce. This is about a fundamental human connection.
I love that. More precious than property rights. Man, that should be framed on every family court judge's wall.
I agree. It sets the tone, right?
What?
Now, prong number two, it gets into the risk of error. So in the context of Santosky, they were looking at how likely is it that a court could screw up, that they could wrongly terminate parental rights using this fair preponderance standard?
I mean, if it's just 51%, that seems like there's a lot of room for error.
Right. And the court, they even looked at statistics, trying to figure out how many families might be torn apart if the bar was set too low.
They were looking at the human cost, not just legal theory.
Exactly. And finally, prong number three, it gets into the government's interest, and it's more nuanced than you might think. It's not just about protecting kids, which is obviously crucial, but it's also about recognizing that families have value. Keeping parents and children together, unless it's absolutely impossible, that's in everyone's best interest.
So you've got these competing interests all wrapped up in this one case. Parental rights, child protection, the best interests of the family as a whole.
It's a balancing act for sure. And the Supreme Court, they had to weigh all of these factors as they wrestled with Santosky v. Kramer. Their decision, well, let's just say it sent shockwaves through the legal system.
Okay, so big question time. After all that back and forth, all those arguments, did the Supreme Court side with the Santoskys? Did they say that fair preponderance was unconstitutional in these cases?
They did, and it was a close one. 5-4 decision. The court said, nope. Fair preponderance of the evidence, it's just not enough when you're talking about terminating parental rights. They declared that the new constitutional minimum, the new standard, had to be clear and convincing evidence.
Wow, 5-4. That's cutting it pretty close. I mean, talk about a divided court. So they raised the bar, made it tougher for the state to take kids away permanently. Why? What was their reasoning?
Justice Blackmun, he wrote the majority opinion, and it's a powerful one. He really dives into why this matters, why this case is such a big deal. He starts by saying that a child's best interests and the parent's rights, they're not necessarily at odds with each other before termination proceedings even start.
Okay, so basically, until a parent is proven unfit, assume that they want what's best for their kid.
Right. Both the child and the parent, they've got a shared interest in preserving that relationship. And then Justice Blackmun goes on to emphasize just how huge, how irreversible termination really is. He actually said there's no undo button once those parental rights are severed.
No undo button. Man, that's a powerful way to put it.
It is. It really makes you stop and think, right? These decisions, they have real consequences. You can't just, like, change your mind later.
So Justice Blackmun is basically saying, because of that, you need more than just a 51% certainty. You need a much higher level of proof before you could break up a family permanently.
Exactly. We can't be gambling with people's lives, with children's futures, on something as flimsy as fair preponderance.
All right, so the majority ruled in favor of a higher standard. But what about the other justices? What did the dissent have to say? Any strong opinions on the other side?
Oh, yeah, there were definitely some concerns. Justice Rehnquist, he wrote the main dissent, and he was worried about delays. He argued that this new higher standard of proof, it could bog down the system. Cases could drag on and on while the state tries to gather more evidence.
And in the meantime, kids are stuck in limbo.
That was his concern. Time is critical in these cases, and any delay could potentially harm the child.
I see the point. So it's like this constant tension, right? Trying to protect kids from harm, but also making sure we're not unjustly stripping parents of their rights, and all while trying to move things along quickly enough the kids aren't left in uncertain situations for too long? How has that tension played out since Santosky?
It's a tough question, and there are no easy answers. But one thing's for sure, Santosky didn't end the debate, not by a long shot. It just opened up a whole new chapter in family law.
So this wasn't just about the Santosky family. This decision had ripple effects.
Huge ripple effects. After Santosky, over 35 states changed their laws. They adopted the clear and convincing evidence standard. It basically set a new baseline for these kinds of cases, a constitutional minimum.
Wow, so one case brought by one family ended up changing the rules for families across the entire country. But Santosky, it didn't stop there, did it? Its legacy goes beyond just termination cases, right?
Absolutely. It's informed legal decisions in all sorts of family law contexts. It shaped how we think about parental rights, the role of the state, the whole balance of protecting kids versus preserving families.
Okay, so give us an example. How has Santosky been used in other cases?
Well, for example, there's the case of Troxell v. Granville. This one was decided in 2000, and it dealt with grandparent visitation rights. Basically, the question was, when can grandparents ask the court to let them see their grandkids, even if the parents say no?
Interesting. So not directly about terminating parental rights, but still related.
Exactly. And the court in Troxell, they leaned heavily on Santosky. They said, look, Santosky made it clear, parents have a fundamental right to make decisions about their kids, including who they get to see.
So Santosky was like this foundation, this bedrock principle that the court used to build upon in Troxell.
That's a great way to put it. And to really understand the weight of Santosky, to grasp how significant it is, there's this analogy that a lot of legal folks use. They call termination of parental rights the death penalty of family law.
Whoa, that's pretty intense. But I get it. It emphasizes just how serious these decisions are. We're not talking about traffic tickets here. We're talking about permanently severing a family bond.
Exactly. It's not something to be taken lightly. And Santosky, it reminds us of that. It's a landmark case that forces us to approach these situations with the utmost care and consideration.
Okay, so we've got the history, the legal battle, the Supreme Court's decision, the lasting impact of Santosky v. Kramer. But what about today? What's happening now? How is this case shaping the legal world we're living in?
Well, Santosky set a minimum standard, a constitutional floor, but it didn't set a ceiling. Some states have gone even further to protect parental rights. They've gone above and beyond that clear and convincing standard.
So they've built on Santosky, made it even tougher to terminate parental rights.
Yeah, they've added extra safeguards. Take Texas, for example. They've adopted what they call a clear and unequivocal evidence standard in some cases.
Clear and unequivocal. So basically, like, no doubt whatsoever.
Pretty much. It's a subtle difference from clear and convincing, but it reflects a real commitment to protecting parental rights.
I mean, if it was my family on the line, I'd want that highest level of certainty for sure.
Of course. But even with these higher standards, there are always complexities. Cases aren't always clear cut. And Santosky, it continues to be a source of debate and discussion.
So it's not just a settled issue, a done deal. There are still gray areas, still questions being raised.
Oh, absolutely. And one area that's particularly interesting and often tricky is how the clear and convincing standard from Santosky interacts with something called the Indian Child Welfare Act, or ICWA for short.
Now, ICWA, that's a whole other can of worms, right?
Yeah.
For folks who might not be familiar, what's the gist of ICWA?
So ICWA was enacted in 1978, same year Santosky made it to the Supreme Court, and it was designed to address a really tragic problem, Native American children being removed from their homes and communities at disproportionately high rates.
There was a long history of that, wasn't there? Taking Native American kids away from their families, often for reasons that were, well, let's just say not very good reasons.
Right. And ICWA was meant to stop that, to protect Native American families, to affirm the right of tribes to make decisions about their own kids.
Makes sense. So how does Santosky play into that? How do these two laws, both focused on families, work together? Or maybe sometimes clash?
Well, ICWA has its own set of rules, its own standards for removing and placing Native American children. And those standards are often even stricter than clear and convincing.
So you've got these two layers of protection working in tandem. Or maybe, sometimes, creating friction.
Yeah, it can get complicated. Two sets of rules trying to achieve similar goals, but sometimes pulling in different directions.
It sounds like a legal maze. You need a map and a compass to navigate all that.
It's true. Family law, it's definitely not for the faint of heart. It's not just about applying black and white rules. It's about understanding the nuances, the human stories, the complexities of every single case.
And being culturally sensitive.
Right.
Recognizing that families come in all shapes and sizes, with different traditions, different ways of doing things.
Absolutely. We can't just impose a one-size-fits-all approach. We need judges, lawyers, social workers, everyone involved in these cases to be culturally competent, to understand the families they're working with.
It's a tall order, but it's essential.
It is. And I think that's one of the reasons Santosky v. Kramer remains so relevant today. It reminds us that the law isn't static. It's a living, breathing thing that has to adapt to the changing world around us.
So we've been unpacking Santosky v. Kramer, and it's clear this case was a game changer. It shifted the landscape for parental rights. But it didn't solve everything, did it? Like, what are some of the legal knots we're still wrestling with today because of it?
You're right. It's not like Santosky dropped the mic and walked off. It really kicked off some big debates that are still going strong. One of the thorniest issues is, how do we actually define parental fitness?
Yeah, that seems like a minefield. What does it mean in real life to be a good enough parent?
Yeah.
It's not exactly something you can measure with a ruler.
It's super subjective, right? But we're asking courts to make these judgments, to draw lines in the sand that can literally change the course of people's lives.
It feels almost impossible to get it right all the time.
And Santosky didn't give us a neat little definition, a checklist for fitness. It focused on how to prove a parent is unfit, but that bigger question, the good enough question, that's still up for grabs.
Which means different courts, different judges could interpret it in different ways.
Exactly. And parenting, just like any human behavior, it's not black and white. It's a whole spectrum. So the law has to deal with that messy reality. It's like, where's that tipping point? When does a parent just need some extra help, some support, versus when their actions are so dangerous that the only answer is termination?
It's a judgment call. A really tough one.
It is. And it gets even trickier when you factor in things like cultural differences or, say, a family's economic situation.
Right. Like, what might be considered normal parenting in one community could be seen as problematic in another.
Totally. We have to be so careful about letting our own biases, you know, the stuff we don't even realize we're carrying around, influence how we see a parent's ability to take care of their child.
So it's not enough for judges and lawyers to just know the law inside and out. They need that cultural awareness, that sensitivity to what different families look like.
Exactly. We need cultural competence baked into the whole system. We need judges who ask hard questions, who challenge their own assumptions, who really make sure their decisions are based on a true understanding of each family's unique situation.
We need less judgment, more understanding.
That's a great way to put it. And let's not forget about the folks on the ground. Social workers, they're often the first ones interacting with families in the system.
They're the ones going into homes, seeing things firsthand, trying to figure out what's really going on.
Right. They have a huge impact on how these cases unfold. But it's a tough job, often with way too many cases and not enough resources.
And it's emotionally draining, I'd imagine.
It can be. They're making decisions that can change the course of a child's life. We need to make sure they have the training, the support, the supervision they need to handle that responsibility.
It's like they're walking this tightrope, trying to protect the child, respect the parents' rights, and navigate a system that's often overloaded.
And they're doing it all while trying to figure out what's truly in the best interest of that child.
It's a heavy load to carry.
It is. And it really highlights why we need everyone talking to each other, working together. Legal folks, social workers, child development experts, policymakers. We all need to be at the table.
So it's about more than just winning or losing individual cases. It's about building a system that actually works for families.
Exactly. A system that's fair, that's compassionate, that focuses on keeping families together whenever possible. And I think Santosky, even though it was about one specific legal issue, it pushed us closer to that goal. It forced us to look in the mirror and say, hey, is this really working? How can we do better?
It sparked a conversation that's still going on today.
And a conversation we need to keep having. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Santosky v. Kramer, think about this. How do we create a child welfare system that truly prioritizes the well-being of children while still respecting the rights of parents? How do we find that balance?
That's the million-dollar question. And there's no easy answer. But I think engaging in these tough conversations, wrestling with these complex issues, that's the first step. So to all our deep divers out there, keep exploring, keep asking hard questions, and keep fighting for a legal system that protects the most vulnerable among us.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
That's a wrap for this deep dive into Santosky v. Kramer. Join us next time as we unearth another fascinating legal gem right here on The Deep Dive.